This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. We have our panel of trumpet writers here ready and eager to discuss the important events of this past week. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be with you.
And Andrew Miller.
Great to be here.
And also via Skype from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And via Skype from Jerusalem, we have Brent Nachtigall.
Thanks for having me.
Ever since Britain's dramatic decision in June to leave the European Union, that story seems to have died down quite a lot, at least in terms of creating more dramatic headlines. But for those who are watching, Europe continues to provide reminders as to why Britain felt it had to go. EU officials handed down a stunning ruling this last week against American computer company Apple, and it amounted to a strong power grab aimed at taking taxation and spending powers from national states and concentrating them at the EU level. And for this story, we're going to go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
That's what the European Union have done, I think, is pretty clever here. They've taken an issue that is very popular right now, tax avoidance. Apple pays a tiny amount of corporation tax. It manages to exploit loopholes and things, I think, so that a lot of its profit is generated by companies that don't technically reside anywhere. And so I think that there are a lot of people are quite miffed about this. And so the European Commission is using that anger as a basis for a massive power grab, not just against Apple, but against Ireland and just about all of the European Union. So what they've done is they've ruled that a arrangement that Apple had in place with Apple and their corporate tax regime is illegal. They've said it violates EU state aid rules and EU competition rules. And so then they have ordered the Irish government to claim $13 billion worth of back taxes from Apple.
€13 billion.
€13 billion. Yes, that's right. And so Ireland's not happy about this. The United States government is not happy about this. Apple is not happy about this. And we have an article from Ambrose Evans-Pritchard in the Trumpet Weekly. And I think one of the things that he does very well is he sets up just the power that Europe's competition directorate has. He writes that they can dispatch SWAT teams on corporate dawn raids across Europe without a search warrant. It operates outside the normal judicial control that we take for granted in a developed democracy. The U.S. Justice Department could never dream of acting in such a fashion. It acts as judge, jury, and executioner and can, in effect, impose fines large enough to constitute criminal sanctions, but without the due process and protection of criminal law. And he argues very strongly that what the European Commission is doing here, it goes way beyond the rule of law. There's no legal basis for what they're doing, but they're just taking a very popular hot-button issue, corporate tax avoidance, and using that to extend Europe's power.
This certainly isn't an unusual behavior for Europe. This kind of thing seems to come up quite often.
Right. And you mentioned Brexit. I think it is interesting a bit the timing because, you know, people have been asking, well, is the EU going to change its ways? Is it going to decide, well, OK, enough is enough. We've consolidated too much power centrally. We've launched too many power grabs. We've put off Britain. We need to calm down. We need to stop doing this kind of thing. And it's a very clear, absolutely not.
Right. So give us an idea of what kind of a reaction there is to this within the United States, within Ireland, and maybe even within Europe.
Well, first of all, Apple have said they're going to appeal this to the European Court of Justice. That's probably not going to work because the European Court of Justice is basically a law unto itself. It's proven over the years it doesn't care about what the law actually says. It just always rules in favor of more Europe, and it has done that for years. Ireland have said that they are joining Apple's lawsuit, so they don't agree with this. Ireland's finance minister said that accused Europe of overreaching their confidence. They said the European treaties say that individual states are responsible for taxation policy. This is an approach through the back door to try and influence taxation policy through competition law. So they quite clearly see it as Europe trying to launch a power grab for taxation policy. And as we've talked about when it comes to the euro crisis on this program, taxation policy is absolutely central to what makes a nation state. You know, along with control of an army, control of raising funds from that state is so much of what makes a government. You know, the British job title of prime minister grew out of the person who had control of the spending. So if Europe can get control of the spending in individual nations and start dictating laws of how spending happens, that is one of the biggest practical steps possible towards a super state. And so you see the European Commission and the European Competition Directorate now trying to use that. Now, within the United States, I think there's a lot of talk, but not much action. I think the United States has big potential. They could really punish Europe if they wanted to. There is an obscure law, I think dating back to the 1930s, that says that the United States can double corporation tax on countries from any country that singles out American corporations. So it could, in response to this, double the corporation tax on European countries. Now, that would probably be challenged in court. It'd be a bit of a legal mess. It doesn't look like they're even going to go there, though. And Apple is not the only target. You know, Europe is very jealous of the dominance that America has in the technological world. It's a dominance that America has for good reason. Someone made the point, you try and start your business in a garage in Europe, it's not going to happen.
Right.
In America, it can. There's a reason America has that dominance, but Europe would like to legislate that dominance away. So it's going to start to go after Amazon, Facebook, Google. They regularly, every time they seem to be running out of money, they sue Microsoft for a few more billion. So it's quite clear they're targeting U.S. companies. America has complained. They probably will complain, but there's no indication they're actually going to do much more than just complain.
Well, just looked at from a practical standpoint in Ireland, for them to be basically responsible for collecting, what, 13 billion euros in back taxes from Apple puts them in a really awkward position, particularly given the fact that they disagree with the ruling to begin with.
Right. And it's a unelected bureaucracy overruling an elected national government. I mean, maybe you don't like the idea of your country charging low taxes. Fine. Well, you know, this is in a democracy. There's a system for doing that and for changing that. Ireland's democratically elected government has decided on this tax rate. And meanwhile, though, you do see a clear double purpose or hypocrisy here within Europe, because then when it's Germany that wants to put out a favorable relationship with Gazprom, a Russian company that, if not clearly breaking EU laws, definitely comes far closer than Apple, the European Commission and the European Competition Directorate just waves that right through. So it also depends very much on who the country is that's offering these beneficial relationships.
Well, as you said, this really does show Europe's true colors and its response to the Brexit referendum. It's not going to change the way that many people would have hoped that it would. And really, this kind of power grab, we can expect to see more of this. There doesn't seem to be anything that would discourage them from taking this kind of action in the future. We appreciate that story, Richard. It seems like really a theme that we end up talking about quite a lot on this program is how authoritarianism is manifesting itself in today's world more and more. We just heard one form of it in Europe, and now we're going to look at another form of it in Asia. China's continued aggressiveness in the South China Sea is taking a new form, and it has neighboring nations particularly worried, especially Japan. For this story, we are going to turn to Jeremiah.
Yes, listeners probably remember the very murky, shadowy nature of Russia's invasion of Ukraine starting back in 2014 in Crimea and in eastern parts of the nation. And it was murky because Vladimir Putin did not deploy battalions of official Russian soldiers, adorned in their uniforms and brandishing the Russian flag. Instead, he sent in what came to be called little green men. These were covert troops or paramilitary soldiers wearing no official insignia, and the military vehicles all had their number plates and identifying marks removed. These were Russian troops and pro-Russian militiamen, but they didn't look like it. And so with all of that insignia removed, Putin was able to deny involvement and say that all those forces were basically just Ukrainian separatists fighting against the pro-Western government in order to bring Crimea under Russian control. And the tactic worked really well for Moscow. It gives Putin plausible deniability. He can basically say, this is not happening based on my orders. I can't help what these independent militias and forces do, whether they're fighting, you know, for Russia or not. And it really kind of bamboozled the U.S. and Ukraine and other Western powers because it wasn't a clear-cut invasion. So we didn't quite know how to respond. And while it was happening, these little green men orchestrated the sham election there in Crimea, which made Crimea an official part of Russia. And then they locked eastern Ukraine into that conflict that it remains in to this day. So it was really effective. And now China is following this same pattern in its drive to assert control over the East China Sea. Just in the last few weeks, China has sent 300 vessels into the waters around the Senkaku Islands. And these islands are controlled by Japan, but they're claimed by China. And what's really complicating matters for Japan is that China is not deploying official military craft. Instead, it's sending irregular militias and fishing boats, or you could call these little green boats, to take a page out of Putin's book there. So it's a brilliant tactic on China's part, just as it was brilliant for Russia to send those little green men in. This method allows for an expansionistic push against the status quo, but not in a way that allows Japan to react militarily.
Well, how do we know that these unmarked boats are Chinese and that they're sent by the Chinese government?
Well, they are they're fishing craft in many cases, but they are often equipped with weaponry. They're often accompanied by Coast Guard vessels, although the Coast Guard will stop just at the edge of where the water becomes officially Japanese territory. So it's pretty obvious to anyone looking at the Coast Guard behavior there, and just wondering why independent fishermen would have any reason to really push into this area. It's a very political move, but the way it's happening, it is difficult for Japan because you can't really confront that with a military reaction when China says, hey, these are just fishermen. We have no control over them. Even though it's quite easy to disprove that plausible deniability kind of just makes it pretty complicated.
Well, in the case of Russia pushing into Ukraine, it seemed like there were a lot of nations that were willing to play along with that ruse because of a fear of confronting Russia. Is that basically what we're seeing here with respect to China?
Well, Japan, I think, is not really afraid to confront them. So far, they've confronted this activity just with diplomacy. They've been doing phone calls in the middle of the night to their counterparts in Beijing and saying, you know, stop this, which is a tactic usually China uses with Japan. They do these 4 a.m. phone calls just to be as annoying as possible. but yeah, the U.S. has recently affirmed that it would go to Japan's aid militarily if the Senkaku Islands were under attack. So I would imagine President Obama is happy to have a reason not to have to do that.
So it's not aimed so much at preventing Japan from reacting, but America, Japanese allies.
I think so, yeah. And if we learn from the recent history of Russia in Ukraine, when the Obama administration and so many Western powers were just totally caught off guard by these little green men, then it seems like the U.S. would take this trend very seriously and avoid making that mistake with China's little green boats. But at the same time, maybe he's happy to have kind of a reason to back off.
All right. Interesting to watch. Thanks for that, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. While there are a lot of nations concerned about China's growing power and how it's going to use it. This great Asian giant does have admirers as well. Among them is a certain Canadian politician with some interesting sympathies for the Chinese government. To learn about this, we're going to turn to Andrew.
Yeah, this is interesting because the Trudeau family in Canada, you've got Justin Trudeau, who's the prime minister now, and his father, Pierre Trudeau, who was prime minister in the 70s, have always been pretty good friends of China. Pierre Trudeau, the father, was the first Canadian prime minister to recognize communist China and the first Canadian prime minister to visit China after the communist revolution. He visited Chairman Mao and other Chinese officials, and actually bringing his son Justin with him as a child. So this is actually Justin Trudeau's second visit to China as in a government delegation, because he'd accompanied his father years ago. But this is his first visit to China since he himself has been prime minister. And it's primarily aimed at trying to revitalize the Canadian economy. The Canadian economy has been contracting recently. It's down, GDP is down about 1.5% this year, last I checked. And so he's trying to really... China's Canada's second biggest trade partner, so just really reaffirm the relationship there, and probably most significantly try to get some Chinese investment into the oil sector. I know they're having some trouble with the oil sector since they had that fire at Fort McMurray, burnt down a bunch of their infrastructure, so they're trying to get that back up on its feet, because the previous Canadian Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, he'd actually kind of put the kibosh on some of this Chinese investment. He said it's okay if a privately owned company, as most companies in America or Europe are, invest in the oil sector in Canada. But he said for a state-owned company like these Chinese companies to put all this investment in here, he said we probably need the money, but it's a national security threat to have a foreign government owning your oil infrastructure.
But Prime Minister Trudeau doesn't have those concerns.
Yeah, he hasn't. He's definitely over there to talk about investment, and his finance minister from Canada, who's with him on the trip, had mentioned to the press just before they left on Monday that he's definitely open to reversing that previous decision by Mr. Harper and getting that Chinese investment back in there.
Well, just to get back into maybe some of the ideological sympathy that he and his father have had, you mentioned his father was actually quite sympathetic and had written about the Chinese government quite glowingly. How much do we have that same kind of a sense from the current prime minister?
Right. You are definitely right in that the father was very authoritarian in his outlook on economic issues. He'd widely praised Fidel Castro as someone who had a good economic system to help the Cuban people, and then even wrote a book, I think it was Innocence Abroad in Red China, about his visit to China before he was prime minister, just really lavishing praise on Chairman Mao for this communist dictatorship he'd established to try to redistribute wealth to the poor. And it was interesting. I know when Justin Trudeau was elected prime minister, they were wondering how much that had rubbed off on him. And so they asked him about 2 years ago. They said, of all the nations on the earth other than Canada, whose government do you admire most? And he was quiet for a few minutes if you watch the video footage from this press conference, because he thought about it. And then his answer was interesting, because he said, well, probably China. And he said they've got this basic dictatorship model over there that just allows them to turn their economy around on the dime, because they don't have to debate with Congress or Parliament or any of these legislative bodies. They can just a top-down structure. So he's definitely expressed sympathy for this dictatorial means of managing an economy, which would show why he probably wouldn't have some of Stephen Harper's reservations about letting a state-run Chinese company invest in Canada's oil structure.
It's amazing, these examples of liberal politicians and liberal journalists who have that kind of common interest with the most authoritarian leaders in the world. Thomas Friedman from the New York Times mentioned a similar kind of a sympathy that he had for the Chinese government, just how much this helps them to get things done. and how it would be great if the United States could just be China for a day so that we could kind of pass through a lot of the legislation that tends to get hung up within our multi-tiered government system that's got built-in checks and balances that prevent things from moving too quickly. But that people tend to equate the more conservative side in the United States with the more authoritarian model of government. But typically it's the more liberal politicians that have those kinds of that kind of admiration, like you're suggesting.
Right. Yeah. Because even here, I think President Obama has been a little more careful than Prime Minister Trudeau on praising China's dictatorship. But when he was in Cuba a few months ago, he definitely had praised Raul Castro's approach to both government health care and government run education.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for that, Andrew. We are going to zip over to the Middle East now. As we've talked about before on this program, Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas decided to hold elections throughout the Palestinian territories this coming October. And this could end up making Palestinian politics quite a lot more radical. To hear about the latest in this story, we're going to go to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
We are featuring in this week's Trumpet Weekly at length an article written by Carolyn Glick, a columnist here from the Jerusalem Post, because it is so... It just supports something that we've been saying for a long time and how that Hamas is going to come to dominate the West Bank. So I really encourage people to read that. But she starts off her article saying, like it or not, the day is fast approaching when the Palestinian Authority we have known for the past 22 years will cease to exist. Palestinian Authority leader Mahmoud Abbas's U.S.-trained Palestinian security forces have lost control over the Palestinian cities in Judea and Samaria, or the West Bank. His EU and U.S.-funded bureaucracies are about to lose control over the local governments to Hamas, and his Fatah militias have turned against him. So this is a barrage of attacks on the authority of Mahmoud Abbas in the shadow of these elections that are going to happen in October. And the way that she sees it is she almost sees it as inevitable that Hamas is going to win those elections. And because of that, you have a lot of people in Fatah, the rivaling Palestinian factions that have lent support to Abbas over the years, that are already jumping ship in a number of key cities in the West Bank. You have there was a delegation of tribal leaders from Hebron this week that went to of themselves without the authority of the Palestinian Authority of Mahmoud Abbas over to Jordan to discuss what's going to happen after the election. You have a lot of Fatah terrorist cells as well that are actually fighting against not Israel but the Mahmoud Abbas's security forces himself, because they're trying to position themselves for the eventual Hamas takeover. And they probably see which way the wind's blowing and realize that they're going to have to come under Hamas's umbrella soon. So it's really interesting to see the lead up to these elections and how many of groups of the Palestinians themselves that are already ditching their allegiance to Mahmoud Abbas.
A pretty spectacular miscalculation on Abbas's part if he intended to cement his power calling for these elections.
Right. He assumed, as we've even discussed on this program before, that Hamas would not participate in these elections. The last time that they were held, Hamas didn't participate, and Fatah and he basically continued his leadership over the Palestinian Authority because of that. And yet when he announced them this time, Hamas came out and said, yes, we are going to participate in that. And it seems that the fact that a lot of people are jumping ship from supporting Abbas has to do with a policy that Israel has started to implement as well. It seems like Israel are jumping ship. When it comes to dealing with the Palestinians, dealing with Palestinian issues, for the past 22 years, it has been a policy of the Israelis that they had to speak through the Palestinian Authority or speak with the Palestinian Authority, because the Palestinian Authority were the representatives of the Palestinians. And yet the defense minister, Avigdor Lieberman, he recently was made defense minister, and he has enacted a different policy whereby the Israelis speak directly to Palestinian businessmen. They speak directly to Palestinian tribal leaders. And they have sort of enacted a carrot and stick approach whereby they reward different towns, different municipalities for their ability to clamp down on terrorism. If they're seen to, you know, not be supporting terrorism, then they're going to encourage business deals with Israelis and the Palestinians in that specific town. And what we're seeing is there are a lot of Palestinian businesses that are, you know, for this process, and it's delegitimizing the rule of Mahmoud Abbas because he has no power now over whether the Israelis are going to increase spending on in these towns, develop infrastructure in these towns or not.
Truly remarkable development. I'd like to just encourage our listeners to go back and read the article that you, Brent, wrote just a week or so ago, The Coming Arab Takeover of East Jerusalem, because this really is a story with dramatic prophetic implications. There's a whole section in our booklet, Jerusalem in Prophecy, that talks about a prophecy in Zechariah that could be dramatically fulfilled very soon as a result of these elections in the Palestinian territories. We appreciate you bringing that back to our attention, Brent. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. One more story before the break. Big changes in the Central Asian nation of Uzbekistan. This nation has been ruled by one man for decades, but exactly what has happened to him right now is unclear. To learn about why this mystery really could prove to be quite significant, we're going to go back to Richard.
Yes, you don't hear much about Uzbekistan, but that could be about to change. It has been ruled by Islam Karimov pretty much since it became independent from the Soviet Union back in 1990. This one man has been in charge. It's been an authoritarian regime, and now he is probably dead. He missed some very significant public engagements this week. He was definitely ill. Now various different conflicting reports are coming in. I think leaders in Turkey have announced that he is in fact dead. Some Russian news sources have reported that he is dead. Some sources within Uzbekistan have denied that. If he is not dead, though, he's probably very close to it. And there's, in fact, rumors that funeral preparations are now underway. And this could be a big deal because this regime has no experience of a transition of power. There's no accepted way to hand over power. His family is kind of split between two daughters who are feuding with each other. There is no heir apparent. There is no clear successor. There are a few rival factions who he has kind of balanced and just about managed to keep in line. But with him gone, Uzbekistan could well explode or collapse. And there's a real danger that this just that the government and the country could disintegrate.
And what does a leaderless Uzbekistan mean? What happens in that country if he's gone?
Well, it's not good. So Uzbekistan is one of the biggest. Uzbeks are some of the biggest contributors to Islamic jihadist movements in Central Asia. They have contributed. They've been Uzbek Islamists in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, in Syria. So there is a strong, I think it's unclear exactly how strong, but there is a strong element of Islamic extremism in Uzbekistan. And then to make matters worse, the borders of all of these Central Asian states were drawn up by Joseph Stalin. And they were drawn up exactly the way you would expect borders drawn up by a paranoid megalomaniac to be. He's drawn it up to kind of lock a lot of these countries in perpetual conflict. They aren't particularly clear borders. They leave large ethnic minorities in other people's countries. But the consequence of this means that Uzbekistan falling apart could very easily spread chaos to the neighboring countries and display a huge impact on destabilizing the entire region.
We are talking about a former Soviet republic, and we've talked quite a bit about how much Vladimir Putin has sought to reconstruct that old Soviet empire. How much does that come into play with Uzbekistan?
Right. So I think that's probably exactly what will happen. And Geopolitical Futures, they wrote that there are potentially massive geopolitical ramifications from what's going on in Uzbekistan. And I think, you know, Putin can't allow just a collapse in Uzbekistan to happen. And so I think we will quite possibly have to see much greater Russian involvement in this sphere that now has strong Russian influence, but used to have Russian dominance. And so I think it could well lead to a much greater Russian control in Central Asia. Now, the Russians are quite constrained right now. They have serious financial constraints. Maybe they will have to get Chinese help in stabilizing the region. So perhaps you could see some more of that dente between the two nations. But ultimately, I think you could see a Russian expansion of power into that region to stop things completely falling apart. And they'll probably do that by backing one of the factions very strongly. And perhaps you'll see unofficial Russian troops or something like that on the ground in Uzbekistan soon.
More little green men. Vladimir exactly. Putin never seems to be a man to let a crisis like this go to waste. We appreciate that, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about nuclear weapons. North Korean soldiers have actually been issued a very unique form of nuclear power. President Obama is enacting plans to make American nukes stationed in Europe more usable. We'll also talk about Iran launching a new armed force and the reason why Britain is considering legalizing polygamy. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
The Iranian nuclear deal has brought concerns about nuclear weapons back into mainstream news. But we're going to talk about a couple of other non-Iran-related nuke stories here. We're going to start with North Korea, a very troubling story from this Asian nation, particularly if you're from South Korea. For this story, we're going to go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, North Korea has apparently established a unit of infantry whose members are being trained to carry nuclear backpacks. And in the event of war, they'll infiltrate South Korea and then detonate these weapons. This was first reported by Radio Free Asia this week, and the speculation is that these would essentially be suicide troops, similar to the kamikaze units that Japan used to attack Allied warships back in World War II. Radio Free Asia said that the North Korean troops are being told that an aircraft carrier will capsize even if their nuclear backpack is detonated at a distance away from it. So a few photos have been released of soldiers wearing these backpacks, and they're marked with the black and yellow radiation symbol, and they look pretty terrifying, I think. It is North Korea, though. They're not exactly known for producing the most sophisticated and reliable weaponry, and they have been known to do some saber rattling with this kind of thing that makes the threat seem far greater than it actually is. But even still, the North has made some major gains in miniaturizing its nuclear weapons in recent years, and we know that the regime is just as unpredictable and as unstable as it could be. So it is a worrying development. And I think it's worrying in large part because of what you mentioned there, the nuclear deal that we recently made with Iran. If you look at recent history with North Korea, back in 1994, the Clinton administration made a very similar deal with the North Koreans. It basically said North Korea has agreed to freeze its nuclear weapons program. It has agreed to accept international inspections of all its existing nuclear facilities. And the whole thing is a giant step toward peace and safety. And if that sounds familiar and like the language that we heard in President Obama's speeches about the nuclear agreement with Iran, that's because the selling points and a lot of the language and the speeches were almost exactly the same. And then with North Korea, just a few years went by, and then it detonated its first nuclear bomb, and in stark violation of the agreement that it had made with the Clinton administration. And then it's detonated several others since then. So if you look at that history and just how defiant North Korea has become, whether or not these nuclear backpacks really do pose a viable threat or not, it still, I think, should make Westerners less optimistic about Iran holding up its end of the more recent nuclear deal. this same kind of agreement was an utter failure with North Korea. We have lots of evidence showing that. And now I think the evidence is also mounting that shows that our more recent deal with Iran is also not likely to bring any sort of peace.
You never know what you're going to get with North Korea. These types of things, it very well could be a very real threat that they could use under certain circumstances. The easier it is for them to deploy this kind of technology, the likelier it is that they'll do so, given the circumstances that they think it would be warranted. Well, thanks for that, Jeremiah. We're going to go now to our second story about nuclear weapons, this one from Europe. Since the Cold War, some of NATO's nuclear weapons have been stationed in Germany, and nuclear sharing gives Germany access to this nuclear arsenal. Well, reports emerged recently of plans that President Obama has for these weapons. For this story, we'll go back to Britain and hear from Richard Palmer.
Yes, starting in 2020, the U.S. plans to upgrade the type of bombs that it has in Europe. And last month, Spiegel reported that some of these new B-61-12 bombs will be placed at the Buchel Air Base, along with that's a current location of German nuclear weapons. Now, this is an update on a news story that we've been following closely for quite some time, because it is one that is very important. The B-61 Model 12 bombs they're gravity bombs. They're dropped from an airplane, and they're smart bombs, so they can be guided very precisely to a target. And they're also what's known as variable yield bombs, in that they can be dialed down to produce a very small, or at least what's small for a nuclear explosion, small, or a absolutely massive nuclear explosion. So they're doing those. They're moving those. This article also reported that Germany was looking at refitting its Panzer Tornado, or adjusting these bombs so that they could fit them on their Panzer Tornados. How much of these bombs' capabilities will be available on the German Tornado, I don't think is yet clear. There was talk before that the smart bomb aspect of these would not be available when deployed on the German Tornado. But it's a significant step now that we know that these bombs are definitely going to be rolled out to Germany.
The more precise the bombs are, the more easier they are to steer, and the more that you can vary the yield, the likelier they are to be used. This Guardian Unlimited article that we have in the Trumpet Weekly talks about, in non-proliferation terms, the only thing worse than a useless bomb is a usable bomb. First of all, what is President Obama's rationale for upgrading the utility in these weapons?
I think it's just a case of almost on autopilot. They're left in Europe. They want to keep them in Europe. Europe wants nuclear weapons, especially now that Russia is being more aggressive. They feel that they need them to deter Russia. And so I guess it's just a case of, well, we're upgrading these bombs. We should upgrade some of the European ones too. But one of the things I do really like about this article that we have by Joshua Michels in the Trumpet Weekly is that it talks about some top secret documents back from the 60s that show that the then German defense minister back in the early 60s, Franz Josef Strauss, was actually considering a preemptive strike against Russia using America's nuclear bombs without American permission. And so there's proof that Germany was in the past considering taking these bombs and using them. And I think, like this article points out, that raises some real question marks about Mr. Obama's policy of upgrading these bombs now, and especially as now these bombs will be able to be fitted on the stealthy F-35, which also means that for the first time in history, Europe will have the ability to launch stealth nuclear strikes. And that will be a major upgrade that comes from these bombs and the new airplanes that the Netherlands and Italy, I think, and a few other countries are getting.
It shows an extraordinary level of trust that America has in Germany to put these kinds of weapons at their disposal. And I think any longtime Trumpet reader or a listener to Trumpet Radio would have to be, alarm bells would have to be going off about this, because these NATO bombs that we have stationed in Europe have been a subject of discussion in our literature for decades, even going back to Mr. Armstrong when those were first put over there, and how there are prophecies that show how those bombs are actually going to be used against the ones who put them there. Definitely something that listeners should be aware of. You can go online to thetrumpet.com and look at the article that Josue Michels wrote about this. It points back to an article that Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flory wrote some years ago called Europe's Nuclear Secret. Definitely a prophetically extremely significant story. We appreciate that, Richard. Trumpet Daily radio host Stephen Flory has been talking quite a lot about the ramifications of the Iranian nuclear deal and just how bad that deal has been. But as much as Western thinkers have hoped that the deal would produce a kinder, gentler Iran, another story emerged this week confirmed that isn't going to happen. For this story, we'll go back to Jerusalem to Brent Nachtigall.
Callum Wood has a piece coming out on thetrumpet.com on Sunday, and we included in the Trumpet Weekly this week. And it's about this new army that Iran is creating. It's called the United Shia Liberation Army. So you can tell that it's not necessarily going to be confined to Iran, but it's going to be made up of different Shia members. It looks like that it's going to be focusing on three main areas of operations, Syria, Iraq, and Yemen, all these countries where we've seen Iran's their influence, and even the fact that you've got a lot of different militias and terrorist groups that receive funding from Iran, and even a lot of instructions from Iran, be it fighting in Syria or even the different Shia militias in Iraq, and even the Houthis in Yemen as well. So this new army, it's kind of interesting because a lot of people are blowing it off as being not anything new. I mean, Iran already has proxies in these nations. And yet what I think is very interesting, and what Callum Wood brings out, is the fact that it's probably likely that Iran is wanting greater oversight. They want a different command structure of these various independent groups to try and bring them under the command structure directly from Iran. And Callum Wood, he highlights Yemen as being a very critical area in which this could help a lot. We already see in Iraq and Syria that you've got different proxies of Iran that pretty much act according to Iran's wishes. And yet the Houthis, while they are Shiites and while they do receive weapons and funding from Iran, they are a little bit more independent. And yet, what we can see in Yemen is Iran wanting more control over the Houthis. And I think that's probably why they said, even the Brigadier General of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, he said that Yemen was going to be a focus of this new army.
Another manifestation of Iran's ambitions within the region. And as Callum brings out in this article, really a fulfillment of its role as the king of the south, ruling over that region, and particularly the more radical elements within that region. We appreciate that, Brent. You are listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. Last week, Andrew Miller brought us a story about people who are trying to marry themselves. This week, he's going to talk about people traveling in the opposite direction, marrying several people. Believe it or not, Britain is considering the prospect of legalizing polygamy. To learn why, we'll go back to Andrew.
Yeah, well, we're just starting to see kind of like a strange alliance of convenience in Britain between the homosexual lobby and certain Islamic activists to redefine marriage to mean something other than one man, one woman. About 5% actually of England's population is Muslim now. It's about 3 million people. So, and according to most polls they've looked at, about even though half of those Muslims are very opposed to homosexuality, about a quarter of them are wanting to legalize the traditional Islamic practice of polygamy, allowing them to actually marry up to four wives legally. And as we have this one activist we have in our Trumpet Weekly, Azad Chaiwala, has established two different like matchmaking websites helping Muslims in Britain actually be able to find someone who's be willing to have live in a traditional Islamic polygamous relationship. And he just released a press release this week bragging that he's got 100,000 people who've subscribed up to these websites now. And but he's got on his press release, he's really talking about even bringing that now that Britain's legalized homosexuality on the basis of two consenting adults should be able to get married. He's trying to extrapolate to the case that he's like, well, if I want three wives and they're all willing to marry me, you should be able to use that same legal rationale to have let Muslims or even other people in Britain get married.
So this is one of the issues that was raised when same-sex marriage was being contemplated within the United States, the fact that this could lead to a slippery slope of legalizing other forms of marriage. Here we see this actually being contemplated in Britain, and it's caught additionally in the sights of just trying to accommodate Muslim cultures.
Right. It's definitely going to be, I think that's definitely going to really try to play into like the multicultural aspect of it. And it's, we're still in the early stages of seeing how much traction this is going to get politically, because as you mentioned, there is that move in the United States now. Here it's mostly from like offshoots of the Mormon Church that are now trying to bring up legal cases using the Supreme Court's rationale to get polygamy legalized, which based on the wording of those Supreme Court decisions, there's really no legal blockade to prevent that from happening. The only thing that prevents it is there's only about like 16% support here. I don't know what the political support nationwide would be in Britain, but they've had at least one notable politician from the Green Party who, in response to a question from a homosexual activist, said that would definitely be something that the Green Party would consider.
Well, that would be my question. Is this man who's running this website, I imagine he's talking about facts on the ground, and this is already a practice, but whether or not it would be legal and to what degree that politicians would support it. Richard, do you have any sense of what that would be?
I was going to say to absolutely no degree. I was going to ask Andrew if anybody in any major political party had actually come out in favor of this. It sounds like nobody has. I don't think the Green Party has any real representation. Maybe they've got one MP, I forget. But I mean, they just had a poll in Britain that showed that the majority of the people wanted to ban the burqa. So I would say that this is probably something that has just about no popular support outside of those two kind of camps that you mentioned, the radical left on the one side and the very pro-Sharia camp on the other. I think it would probably be political suicide for a politician to just as it would be in the United States to agree with it.
Well, it is interesting that that would be the case politically within Britain and certainly within the United States. And yet at the same time, you don't hear any real criticism of this practice on the part of Western mm-hmm. politicians. And a lot of people look at the way that politicians treat Muslim societies, that this is not radical among them. And this isn't talking about standing up in opposition against the radical Muslims and those who are waging jihad, but just standard practice within Muslim society that they never talk about the problems inherent in those societies, the way that they tend to trample on women's rights and right. So on. So it is interesting that this, I mean, there is a whole lot of this trend within Britain of these societies existing, using Sharia law as more the basis for their legal decisions locally, and a certain amount of turning the other way on the part of British politicians.
Right, and that's one thing you'll even see more from, like on the American side of things, even though there's only about 16% support for polygamy, the activists for it have also pointed out that the same was true of homosexuality 20 years ago. So those things they seem to be changing quickly.
We appreciate that, Andrew. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. We've been accumulating all of these stories all week, as we do every week, and we've been talking about those stories on the program today. What we talk about here is in The Trumpet Weekly each week, and you can receive it in your email inbox every Friday afternoon. We're going to finish the program with our lightning round of important news from all our panelists. That's coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
It's time now for our lightning round. We'll take one last look at some of the headlines from this week that caught our attention, and we'll start with Richard.
Here's a very revealing quote from Estonia's prime minister. Thomas Mann once said that we want a European Germany, not a German Europe. And he said, in a period when Europe is suffering from crises and must make weighty decisions, I believe we need a Europe that looks more like Germany. We have this quote in an article that talks about growing support for a European army, and Eastern Europe really is looking to Germany and that and in other ways. And just on that subject, just today, Germany's foreign minister said that as he travels all across Europe, support for a European army is growing.
All right, we'll go now to Brent.
Knesset member Michael Oren reportedly said this week to Channel 10 here in Israel that Obama may be going home, but Obamaism will remain a permanent part of American policy. He went on to say that America today is not prepared to send a meaningful force into the Middle East. This is the America that is prepared to sit on the sidelines while 500,000 people are murdered in Syria and while Europe is flooded with refugees. This is the America that doesn't want to be the world's policeman and prefers to focus on its own internal issues. He then called on Israel to realize that this is the reality in which we are going to have to learn to stand on our own two feet.
And now over to Andrew.
A new national survey has shown that marijuana usage is becoming more accepted among Americans, whereas in 2002, a full half of Americans thought that smoking marijuana weekly would be bad for your health. That number's now come down to only about a third of Americans who think weekly marijuana usage is detrimental.
All right, we'll go now to Richard.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel is sounding like she might be getting ready to move Germany closer to Russia. She said that she has the very greatest interest in stopping sanctions against Russia, that she is very keen to look for a reason to do that. She said that as soon as we see progress in the Minsk agreement, that's about Ukraine, we will loosen the sanctions. And then her foreign minister, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, has written a series of articles along the same lines, calling for moving from a phase of confrontations and growing tensions back to a reliable understanding of common security. So you could now see that... rapprochement that we've written about quite a few times on The Trumpet and then thetrumpet.com.
All right, now to Jeremiah.
Chinese dissidents are asking President Barack Obama to press Chinese President Xi Jinping about what they say is the worst human rights crisis since the Tiananmen Square massacre. Mr. Obama will be traveling to China for the G20 summit this week. I think he's actually there now. And Xi's critics hope that Mr. Obama will use this occasion to stand up against the Chinese president. Since President Xi came into power, we've seen many human rights lawyers and activists just mysteriously disappearing. We've seen many NGOs shut down and other civil society organizations and Christian churches have been targeted. So these dissidents want President Obama to stand up against this increasingly authoritarian direction that China is taking.
All right, we'll go back to Brent.
Iranian officials announced on Tuesday that the country is preparing to launch three new satellites into space. Mohsen Bamrami, the director of Iran's Space Agency, which has long been suspected of providing cover for its weapons research, announced that Iran would launch its newest satellite dubbed Friendship later this year. Defense experts and former U.S. officials told the Washington Free Beacon that the test is likely cover for Iran to pursue illicit intercontinental ballistic missile technology, which would enable the Islamic Republic to fire a nuclear weapon over great distances.
And now over to Richard.
Some more worrying statistics for German Chancellor Angela Merkel. In one German state, the right-wing fringe group, the AfD, actually outperformed her Christian Democratic Union. They won 23% of the vote compared to her 20. Another poll showed that 50% do not want Angela Merkel to run for a fourth term. And usually by this time of year, with the elections coming up in 2017, I think it's in autumn, usually at this time of year, she would have announced her candidacy. But she has not. She is going to delay that probably for quite a few months. So that gives you an idea of the kind of uncertainty that's building within German politics.
All right, we'll finish with Andrew.
Well, the good news is that open manufacturing positions in the U.S. economy are standing at a 15-year high. The bad news is that, according to this Wall Street Journal article we have in our Trumpet Weekly, apparently there aren't enough skilled laborers to fill those positions. While we're now getting about 350,000 open manufacturing positions a month, it's taking recruiters an average of 94 days to recruit for such roles, such as a scientist or an engineer.
All right. Thank you, Andrew. And gentlemen, I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Look us up online at thetrumpet.com, and we will send you a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. Tell us what you think of the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be here.
Good to be here.
And thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Theodore Roosevelt. It is a wicked thing to be neutral between right and wrong. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.